This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's being called the Wild West of higher education. We're talking about for-profit colleges and universities, which represent a booming multi-billion dollar industry. And it's attracting increasing state and federal scrutiny.
Here in Massachusetts, Attorney General Martha Coakley is investigating recruitment and loan practices at several for-profit colleges. This comes amidst a growing list of allegations across the country that these schools are saddling students with heavy debt, failing to prepare them for jobs, and in general, focusing on the bottom line instead of education.
Here are a few numbers to put this discussion into context. For-profit colleges are a $400 billion industry. Yes, that's billion with a B. They enroll 12% of the nation's higher ed students, they get a quarter of all federal student aid, and they account for nearly half of all student loan defaults.
And so the feds are proposing tougher regulations. And here in Massachusetts, lawmakers are pushing new laws to crack down on for-profit colleges. Our talker today, the growing business of for-profit colleges. Our intern, Maddie Neufeld, caught up with some students at one of these schools, the Kaplan Career Institute in Boston.
My name is Courtney Richards. I am 21 and I do dental assisting. You know, it's recession proof and the program isn't long.
Are you worried about being able to pay back student debt?
No, because, I mean, they find you a job. So as long as you have a job, this loan's not too bad.
My name is John Jajopoulos. I'm going to Kaplan Institute for Medical Assisting. The cost for Kaplan, the grants kind of covered it. So no, I'm not really worried about accruing debt. Plus, they give you about 10 years afterwards to square up. So I think I'll be all right after I start working.
My name is Faye Needham. I am studying to be a medical assistant, and I'm 28 years old. I would say I'm a little bit worried. You get a little bit paid for, and then you work for free for a month, and I have twin boys at home. I may not be able to work full-time, so I think that the bills might add up.
Some students there at the Kaplan Career Institute, a for-profit school in Boston. Joining us now from the studios of WFCR in Amherst is Deanne Lunan. She's the director of the National Consumer Law Center's Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. Welcome to Radio Boston, Deanne. It's good to have you.
Thank you.
Let's start with this very basic question. What's your biggest concern about for-profit colleges?
Our biggest concern really is the harm that it causes to students who don't succeed at the schools, either because they're not getting jobs or they're not completing the programs, and in those cases are saddled with very high levels of student loan debt. Mm.
And talk about that. How high? Give us some sense of, because you've worked with some of these students, what do you see out there?
Yes, unfortunately, we see a lot of problems. We've been working with borrowers for many years, and the problems have gotten a lot worse as the sector has grown. And the real concern, I don't know that everyone understands, is that when you're in debt on student loans, and particularly on federal student loans, it's very difficult to get out from under that debt. It can haunt you forever. There's no time limit on how long the government can come after you. And so a lot of the people who come to see me already went to for-profit schools, are in default on their loans, and they really want to start over again. They want to go to a school this time and go to a school that's less expensive, one that will actually help them meet their goals, but they are deterred from going back because of the debt they have from before. Mm.
We got some figures from a source, the Education Trust, which reported the problem this way. Almost all students borrow heavily. And now students who earn a BA degree, a bachelor's degree, median debt at a public four-year school, about $8,000. Median debt at a private nonprofit school, about $17,000. Median debt at a for-profit college, which is what we're talking about today, $31,000. So that's almost four times a public four-year school, almost twice a private nonprofit school.
Right, and nearly all of these students borrow, which is not true of other sectors. For example, the community college sector generally has very low levels of borrowing. And we see not just when the federal loan program, but private loans, which are not connected or guaranteed by the federal government, the highest levels of borrowing of private loans also occurs in the for-profit sector.
Mm. So why are we seeing such a surge in enrollment? And I guess let me ask the question this way. To what degree are these for-profit schools responsible for this, I guess?
And that's really the key, because there certainly is demand for higher education, and we want people to be able to go to school, and that's not what this is about. The part that the schools are responsible for is the consumer fraud element of this, the misrepresentations, the false promises, basically the sales at all costs business model that a lot of the schools have. And in that case, they are responsible for those, and that's a big reason why a lot of those students are not succeeding.
So when we talk about the fraud, I read, for example, that the U.S., the General Accountability Office, it sent investigators posing as potential students into for-profit schools. I think it looked at 15 of them. It found that all 15 schools misled or made questionable statements about the actual cost of education and how much students would earn after graduation. Are those the kinds of concerns that you've encountered dealing with the students that you deal with?
Yes, and it's not just those. It's basically, again, it's a very, very aggressive sales pitch. And often when the students come in, if they're given admissions test, or sometimes they have to take a test if they don't have a high school diploma or a GED, I commonly see students who tell me that the answers were given to them, the school gave them the answers to the test. They tell them that they'll have job placement services because they're really selling jobs in a lot of ways, and then they don't have those services. So it's unfortunately a sort of a full range of misrepresentation and fraud, starting from the recruitment and going all the way through to when people are looking for jobs.
So listeners, there's the question, are you enrolled in one of these schools in and around Boston? They include schools like the Kaplan Career Institute, the New England Institute of Art, and the University of Phoenix. Has it been a good experience for you? Has it helped you find a job? Was it worth the money? Give us a call. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'd like to introduce another guest who represents for-profit schools. It's Harris Miller. He's president of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities in Washington, and he joins us from NPR. And good to have you, Harris Miller. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on today.
Sure. So let's be clear. We know that many of these for-profit schools do important work, fill an important role. We're by no means saying that they're all tainted by these allegations, but respond, if you would, to Deanne Lunan's concerns that we're hearing about here in Massachusetts and across the country.
There are 3.2 million students in our sector, and Deanne Lunan is an ombudsman. That's her job. She only hears from that small percentage of students who are really in trouble. And unfortunately, those students also come out of our traditional schools. You just don't hear as much about them. If you ask the ombudsman at the Boston Globe about the quality of the newspaper writing at the Boston Globe and judge it by what he or she heard, you'd assume that every writer at the Boston Globe is incompetent, because the ombudsman only hears about complaints, doesn't hear about successes. But we do have great successes. Our graduation rate, for example, for students in two-year associate degree programs is over 60%. Compared to slightly over 20% at community colleges. And, for example, at Bay State Community College in the Boston area, the graduation rate is only about 11%. Another thing that Deanne forgot to mention is, of course, one of the reasons these community colleges seem to cost less is because there are billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars, state and local taxpayer dollars, going to subsidize these students who, again, are graduating at a rate of slightly above 20%. That's taxpayer dollars that could be used much more effectively if there was some accountability. Mm. Now, there is accountability in our sector. Schools in our sector, in order to maintain their accreditation from the accreditation bodies which are overseen by the U.S. Department of Education, have to maintain certain graduation rates and have to meet certain placement rates of their graduates. That is not true of traditional schools. That's not true of community colleges, which is why so many of them have such abysmal records, whereas our schools do much better in terms of both graduation and placement, particularly given we are dealing with what are called non-traditional students, older students, working adults, often the first in their family to go to college with families, as your intern showed in her preset interview with the student at Kaplan. So these are all indications we're dealing with challenging students who may not have been comfortable or able to access traditional higher education, who come to our schools, graduate in high numbers, and do well in terms of job placement.
All right, Harris Miller, hold that thought because I want to get Deanne Lunan back in the conversation. Deanne, what do you make of that? Harris Miller is talking about graduation rates and suggesting that they're pretty competitive with nonprofits. Is it, you know, is that where the focus should be? And do you agree with that?
Well, the data actually don't support that. And if you go through what Senator Harkin recently held a series of hearings that went through basically the performance data in different sectors, and the numbers back up what Senator Harkin was showing, which is problems, disproportionate problems in the for-profit sector. But that's not to say that there aren't problems in other sectors. There clearly are. But that's in many ways a distraction that the proponents of the for-profit education try to use to get away from the problem that the biggest harm, mainly in terms of defaults and the huge consequences of defaults, is falling on the for-profit students.
Mm. Yeah, and Harris Miller, let me just talk to you about two, really quickly. I don't want to get too bogged down in the weeds here, but as I mentioned earlier, the GAO sent investigators into 15 different for-profit schools. In all 15 cases, they found that they made questionable statements about the actual cost of education and how much students would earn after graduation. Another case, the Justice Department has joined a whistleblower lawsuit with 11 states, including Massachusetts, looking into the for-profit chain Education Management Corps, alleging that the company illegally pays recruiters bonuses for signing up students. I mean, so I guess my question to you is, are there problems in this sector, understanding that you speak for the, you know, for the whole industry? Are there problems that, that you guys need to pay attention to?
Sure there are, and we focus on compliance with the laws and regulations all the time because we have three separate regulators. We have the federal government, we have each of the states, and we have these accrediting bodies. But the GAO report you mentioned, for example, has been substantially discredited. I have great respect for the GAO. I've worked in Washington for 35 years, but I've never heard of a report that had to be reissued with over 16 corrections, every one of the corrections being biased against our sector. And the head of the investigation was transferred, which is another way of saying fired, because the report was so shoddy. So I wouldn't put a lot of dependency on that. As far as a specific investigation the Department of Justice has joined, I can't speak about the specifics of the situation. But just let's be clear what we're fighting about there in those kind of situations. There was a term put in the 1992 law called not allowed to pay incentive compensation and not allowed to be basing bonuses or payment solely on the basis of the number of students enrolled. Well, what we're fighting about is how to define the word solely. That's what this is all about. There's no question about fraud or misleading students. It's just about whether the schools, in the cases that you're talking about, did or did not interpret the word solely correctly. That's what we're fighting about, a very technical issue, not some intention by these schools to violate the incentive compensation rules.
Okay, well, I think Deanne and others might think we're talking about something a little broader here. I want to get the listeners into our conversation. We're talking about for-profit colleges and universities. Are they helping to educate an underserved population, or are they loading them down with too much debt and useless degrees? You can give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Gloucester. Hi, Chris.
How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Go ahead. You're on the air. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, yeah, I've had some experience with the for-profit education system. I went to a for-profit private university. It was actually out of state. It was one down south. It was called South University. And I was actually able to get in there and get what I needed from them and complete a degree and just get back out in the world. And it worked out okay for me, but I saw a lot of unethical stuff going on, and it was a real eye-opener for me.
And, well, such as, what are you talking about, Chris, when you say you saw a lot of unethical stuff going on?
It really seemed like, you know, they just, you know, the MO was to kind of usher people in and make them, you know, make a bunch of promises and just kind of, you know, let people ride the first couple of quarters and get paid for that. And, you know, just kind of, you know, taking people in that they know probably really didn't have, you know, wouldn't really be able to get through some of these really intense programs. and they would just kind of sure along. It seemed like they would kind of beat the numbers a little bit to get them through a couple of quarters.
All right,
and then
Chris.
You would see people flanking out in masses.
Hmm. Chris, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Deanne, respond to Chris's point. Is that the kind of thing that you've seen a lot of?
Yes, and I think actually that point of keeping people in the school, mainly often to capture the federal dollars, is a good way of comparing in some cases, for example, a four-year public university to the for-profits. I've had two clients, for example, recently, both young men in their early 20s, both unfortunately suffered from severe depression and also some substance abuse issues. But the difference really, ultimately, neither was able to really succeed from his education. But here at UMass Amherst, they watched him very closely. They ultimately suspended him because he wasn't performing, whereas the student, the other client I had who was at the for-profit school, they kept him in the school. We have some evidence that they actually falsified when he was attending, when he wasn't really attending. And the difference in terms of debt levels is the young man who went to the for-profit school has over $100,000 in student loans. He's clean now, trying to start over again, and is really unable to get out from under it, whereas the other young man who went to the other college has much less debt, and most of it's federal debt, and he's able to deal with it.
Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Watertown. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. What's on your mind today?
Well, I actually worked both sides of this argument. I started at a for-profit nursing school in New Haven, Connecticut, and now I work at a state school in Salem. But both parties have some kind of facts and figures and some smoke screens that they use. I did work for educational management personally, and I was in admissions, and I never got a bonus for bringing people in. Believe me, I wish I could, but it was against the law. So I wanted to make that point clear. And the previous caller, who was a student at South University, yes, there are some problems happening, but as I said to the screener, I think not just for-profits need to be under the microscope, every institution. I just left a college. It's a private college. I will remain nameless. But they were very unethical, and the president himself told teachers to keep students in. And this is a private school. It's not for profit. And so you have that problem on not just the for-profit side, but both sides. And I wanted to raise that point so that, you know, everybody could understand that it's not just happening at for-profits. It's all over higher ed.
All right, Brian. Well, we really appreciate you bringing the point to our attention. Harris Miller, do you feel like you guys are being picked on when this is a problem that might go across, as our caller suggested, the for-profit and non-profit universe?
Yeah, I don't want to sound paranoid, but as Henry Kissinger once said, even paranoids have enemies. we do have a sense here that there is selection about our sector compared to what happens in all of higher education. For example, people like Deanne want to give you the impression that default problems are somehow much more prevalent in our sector. Yet a major study by professors at Indiana University and the Government Accountability Office itself, which you alluded to earlier in the discussion, both have said publicly several times that default rates are a function of the student demographics, not of an institution's tax status. In other words, if you accept poor students into your school, you're going to have higher default rates, and that's one of the reasons the student loan system was created. So Harvard, that only has about 5% of its students eligible for the Pell Grants, that's the federal grants based on economic status, surprise, surprise, they have a very, very low default rate, whereas many of our institutions have 50 or 60 or 70% of their students eligible for default rates, as do many minority-serving institutions, as do many community colleges that do allow student loans to their students, and we all have about the same default rate. But because the Department of Education doesn't present it that way to the public, they throw together the Harvards with the low-performing schools in their calculations. Somehow people think that we have a unique problem when it is not unique. What we are doing and what we should be praised for and not condemned for is we're trying to serve a huge percentage of our nation's population,
no, Harrison,
which frankly
you
is not being served by the traditional higher education community.
I'm interrupting only because you made that point very eloquently a while back, and I want to try to get at least one more caller in here. And
sure.
Deanne, I also want to get your response to that. But let's first go to Leanna, who's calling from Chelmsford. Hi, Leanna.
Hi. I'm a mother of a child who attended a for-profit school. And my son ended up with, after 3 years of school, he did end up with a bachelor's degree in multimedia technology, but he also ended up with $103,000 in debt.
Wait a minute. I want to just be clear. $103,000. Is that what you just said?
Yes. And part of that money was accumulation of interest.
Right, right. Now let me ask you this: so he got a bachelor's degree. Has he managed to get a job?
He has not managed to get a job in the field in which he has a degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a trouble.
And he has not paid 1 cent toward his student loan.
Right. Well, Leanna, thanks so much for the call. Deanne Lunan out in Amherst, I want to ask you, there are efforts in Massachusetts to essentially to have these schools, these for-profit schools, regulated by the Office of Consumer Protection. Good idea?
Yes, there's a number of bills pending right now that are good first steps in holding the sector more accountable. And one is to have the Division of Professional Licensure have jurisdiction or oversight over a lot of for-profit schools, not all of them. And there's also a number of other proposals, including to provide more relief for students who are harmed by removing the cap on the bond that students can recover from if schools close while they're attending the schools.
Mm. Harris Miller, would your organization, your group of schools object to that, putting essentially what are for-profit businesses into the Office of Consumer Protection for oversight?
What we object to is discriminatory treatment that only affects our schools. We are more than willing, and we do every day live with a lot of rules and regulations, but there's no reason that we should be selected out and given special negative treatment. Let me give you one example that I think Deanne and I agree about. Believe it or not, if a student comes in and wants to borrow more money than he or she needs for education, a financial aid officer today at a not-for-profit or for-profit school is not allowed to say no. You can advise the student not to borrow the money, but the student is allowed to take as much as he or she is entitled to as a maximum under the law. In a recent report by Mark Kantrowitz, who's a well thought of advisor on financial aid, said that there's a huge percentage of money being borrowed by students, not for education, but for personal things, cars, televisions, etc., which is nice, but that's not what the student loan system was designed for. And not surprisingly, a lot of the students who overborrow also default. We need to give schools the power to stop these students from overborrowing.
All right, Harris Miller, we're going to have to stop it there, but we're very grateful for you for the fact that you came in today. Thanks so much. That's Harris Miller, president of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. Also, Deanne Lunan, director of the National Consumer Law Center on Student Loan Borrower Assistance Project. Thank you, Deanne, very much.
Thank you.
And many thanks to our callers. Stay with us. Coming up after the break, the story of how one Maine family packs up to make it in California, and then the recession hits.
It's just there's a part of me that just wants you to fix it.
I'm trying to fix it. I'm trying every f-ing day to fix it.
That's coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.